I'm Brian.
And I'm Reggie.
And this, believe it or not, guys, I know you're going to believe me when I tell you this, but this is R&B Talks.
Yeah, I think they clicked the title, buddy. I think they know what it is.
You never know. Maybe they just had like a fit.
I mean, they don't know if it's Reggie and Brian, but they can notice
like a tremor in the hand and just started clicking stuff, and we popped up. You never know.
I know.
And the internet's tricky, man. It's tricky.
Check it. All right, look, man. I'm so mad.
Why are you mad?
I'm so mad.
You don't sound mad, but okay.
I'm mad at myself, okay? So I get this truck that I really like.
Uh-huh.
You know, traded in my Cherokee for this GMC. It's a Denali. It's very nice. Love
very,
the damn
very
thing,
right? Beautiful truck. I looked at it.
Yeah. So what do I do? I'm moving some trailers and stuff around, and I run over a stump, and I bent the crap out of my bumper already. Haven't even had it like a full week. Bent the bumper.
Yeah, that sucks.
I was so mad.
Oh, I know the feeling.
So mad, dude.
I know the feeling.
It was just one of those things. And like, I roll over this stump, and I'm like, I knew exactly what I had done. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, well, the truck's still running. It's still moving. There's no noises. And I hadn't moved that far. I'm stopped, and I'm like, get out. And I see the air dam laying on the ground, completely ripped off of the front, which I knew, well, that's not a big deal, whatever. I'm like, crap. So anyway, long story long, I'm like, I call up a buddy of mine who does work on stuff, and I said, hey, can you take a look at this real quick? See if there's just nothing damaged beyond whatever. So I drove it over there, which it was fine, a few miles or whatever, and it didn't have anything going on. He took a look at it, and I'll be there. As soon as I like really look at it, like you see the bottom of the bumper and it's just twisted.
Yeah.
And it's just twisted enough where like, if you don't know, you probably wouldn't like really notice that much.
Yeah.
But now that I know, like,
see it.
Oh man. It just, yeah. I see every time I look at my truck, I'm like, damn bumper. And, I'm so mad, dude. I couldn't believe I did. I mean, you know, it's just one of those things where.
Did he say how much it would cost to fix it?
Well, no, not really, because he's not a body guy. He said if I got a new bumper, we could put it on, but new bumper for that with color match and everything is what I found online was like $1,300. So I'm gonna try to. I need to take it to a body shop, see if they'll like just because all it needs is just a twist out a little bit. I don't really care, but put another. You know, just I don't need it perfect. I just want to put it a little bit back to where I don't notice it.
So you don't see it all the time.
Yeah. I mean, that's it, you know, but I know a lot of times these days they don't do anything with body work like that. You think they would, it's like, no, we're not going to fix it. We're just going to get a new part. And that's what, you know, and that's what they do nowadays. There's very few. So I got to find somebody actually can, it's not even that much. It just has to be twisted a little bit and you know, that's it.
Well, anyway. Just reach under there, Hercules, and bend that out.
I'm just me. I mean,
I dig it.
I'll put my freaking foot on that tire and heave it.
There you go. Do it. Do it.
And bust a vein while I'm at it.
Show it your masculineness. Indeed. Your masculineness.
Yes.
So it's time for another new episode of What Annoys Brian. Are you ready?
Oh, let's go.
All right. People who get tattoos and have no idea what their tattoo means.
Oh, that's... really and
here's
weird.
Here's where I started with this.
That's kind of sad, though, honestly.
I was over at the gym one day, you know, getting my workout on, you know, pushing the weight up, bringing the weight down. And a guy walked up to me, and just politely, he asked me if he could work in. And I was like, yeah, I'm good, man. You know, I only got two sets left. If you want to work in, we're good. So he starts working, and he strikes up a conversation with me, and he asked me for some tips. He can kind of tell by the way I'm moving, I pretty much know what I'm doing. And so I ask him, he has these brand new, like full sleeve tattoos on both arms. And I was like, hey man, what kind of tattoos are those? So he goes into this whole thing about the Viking Nordic lore of these tattoos. And I kind of felt like they were Viking tattoos, by the way, you know, the art itself. And I said, oh man, are you like Celtic or Nordic or are you... No, I'm not. Well, why'd you get those tattoos? I thought it would look cool. And I'm like, Well, you suck, dude. I'm like, you know, it's not like that I wanted him to get like, but dude, it's different if you get like a little like Viking tattoo. He had like full 360 down to the wrist sleeves. They had Viking runes on them and everything, like the rune alphabet and everything. And I was like,
yeah.
And I even asked him, I was like, so do you know what that says? And he's like, no, not really. I was like, so you had somebody permanently ink all over your body.
Yeah.
Things that you had. He could be right and you're a complete and utter butthole in Viking and you wouldn't know. Do you need, is that necessary? Or first of all, is it necessary? Like is it necessary to
drink my own urine? No.
But it's sterile and I like the taste. But I'm just like, and I didn't really know how to continue the conversation because he literally was 100% ignorant to what he had permanently pasted on his body.
Oh man, I know, dude. I saw that a lot when I was when I was in the music scene, hardcore, like, you know, playing a lot. Lots of tattoos, dude, that people had no idea about or whatever. Most of the time, they were like, well, I was drunk and I did this, and you're like, yeah, good move, man. Yeah,
solid. Solid.
All right.
I have tattoos. They're hillbilly tattoos. Like, I come from a long line of hillbillies. So
it makes sense.
I have some hillbilly tattoos, but like, that's right. You know, you go back to where I live, you will hear the banjo.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm just saying, I didn't know how to approach Youngblood because he was like 24. And I'm like, you have no idea. Like, and I mean, these were intricate, man. Like, whoever did the art was a great tattoo artist. Like, I bet you there was $5,000 in those sleeves. And no idea. Nothing. Couldn't tell me anything about them, their history. Knew he wasn't Nordic. Knew he wasn't Celtic. Knew he wasn't Icelandic, all the place where the Vikings came from.
It's the same thing with, like, all the tribal stuff. They get all the tribal patterns and everything. Yeah. I mean, like, some of that actually has a meaning, but, like, people just, they just like it. I mean, I don't know.
One of the things there's a dude, and he's a pretty strong Christian guy, I know, and he's got a lot of tattoos, but he can tell you what all of them mean and the meaning behind them and all that. Like, that, I'm like, oh, okay, so I get why you got that. That means that to you and you, but to be like, I spent $5,000 to get Viking sleeves, and the only Viking blood in my family is whatever might have been spilt on the ground they're walking on, because there's none actually in my family. And you're like, okay.
I was
like,
well, but nobody knows really for sure how much Viking stuff is in your family. You can just trace back some things, like meanings, roots of like names and stuff. But like, there's no family records go back to 980.
If Hafthor Bjornsson showed up and was covered in Viking tattoos, I'd be like, I get it.
Well, he's from there. I mean,
but when Ernie from Saskatoon shows up,
Saskatoon
with Viking tattoos, I'm like, Ernie, come on, bro.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, anyway, yeah. I just had to get that off my chest, guys.
Well, we're glad to hear what annoys Brian.
It just bugged me, man. It just bugged me to death.
Yeah.
I was, because I wanted to actually have a conversation about them. I thought they were cool. I thought I was going to learn something.
Well, they are cool. And look, they're just cool. And look, that's all right. Whatever.
Next time I see Ernie from Saskatoon, I'll let him know.
Just tell Ernie, bro, your tattoos are cool. It's okay if you don't know what they mean.
Okay.
I wouldn't do that, but I'm glad that you're happy with your, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sterile and I like the taste. It's sterile.
Yes. Anyway. You can dodge a wrench.
That's right.
You can dodge a ball.
That's right. What a great movie.
I know, bro.
The guy showed up at my job the other day, and he had an Average Joe's uniform on. I thought it was great.
Oh, that'd be so funny.
I laughed so hard.
Oh, yeah.
I told him, I so love that movie. I was like, that's still one of the funniest movies I ever watched. And he's like, I know. He's like, I watch it all the time. And I'm like, it's just Rip Torn and all those people. You just can't help but love that movie. But anyway.
So Halloween was Friday.
Yeah.
I did a worship night that evening. My kids did go trick or treating. Of course, my one daughter dressed up as one of the K-pop demon hunters from that movie. If nobody knows what that is, probably most people who have kids know what that is. It's hugely popular. And then my other daughter dressed up as a, what's she dressed up as? Ladybug from the Ladybug Cat Noir show she likes a lot. French. Anyway.
Did you say a French show?
It's a French show.
French.
It's English French. Dubbed.
English dubbed French.
Yeah. I mean, and it's totally French, dude. It's just weird. But anyway, so that's what they did. They went over to my my brother's neighborhood and did that thing and had some chili and stuff over there.
But that's cool.
Then so I was pretty much at church from like 4:30 till 8, I think, on Halloween night. We had a really great turnout though. That was pretty cool. And it was a fun night. We did a worship set and stuff inside. And then I migrated with my cajon outside and then we like just set up around the, bonfire and just did some worship stuff.
All right, I'm going to ask a ridiculous question. Are you ready? Did you just say you migrated with your cajon?
I did. It's like reverse illegal immigration.
I'm trying to figure out what your cajon is.
It's a percussion instrument. It's a big box basically it's a percussion instrument.
Is it like the box that people sit on?
Yeah. I have that big one. I have a real big one I use. I like it a lot.
Okay, I know what that is.
Yeah,
but when you said
it's cajon, called a cajon.
When you said I was cajon, I was like,
That's what I took that because it was easy to. You can take that and just go set it up and sit on it. And you're good to go.
I'm serious, man. I'm hunting. One of these days, I'm going to get me a used set of drums, and I need you to teach me how to play drums. I feel like I could take out a lot of aggression.
I'm the worst teacher ever, bro.
Why?
I have no patience for anything. Like, why you suck, man? What are you trying to do?
Dude, I've never played drums before.
I know. And I'd be like, yeah, man, it's over. You can't do it.
Don't make me be self-taught because I'll play everything wrong. And then you'll tell me I'm doing everything wrong.
I know. All right, look, so here's the deal. Speaking of things and upon
doing
things,
everything wrong,
you know, everybody is all up about, and they have been, they still are about tariffs and everything else and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and everybody wants to get manufacturing back in the U.S.
Yes.
And it's just, you know, hugely been talked about over and over and over again. It's still being talked about. Still no definite answer on anything.
Yes.
But the question I came across this this one video in particular. It just showed up in my YouTube feed. I don't know, a while back, and it was a guy who like said I want to make this product completely from USA. Materials and processing and whatever. So like and it was a grill scrubber. So it's like the handle had to be all made and everything inside the U.S. The components for everything. So watching that video though, it was an eye opener as to like, we can't get, even if we were to able to get manufacturing back in the U.S., there's a lot of skill sets and stuff now that are just, we have not
gone.
It's crazy. So I wanted to take the time to kind of dig into a little bit about like where are we actually primarily getting our stuff for one. And it's hard. You can't just look, and this varies from industry, by the way, this is just a generalized thing. Like who do we import the most goods from, who manufactures a lot of things and all this stuff. And so that's what we're going to get into a little bit at a very high level. I'm not going to dig into everything. I'll be honest. Like, I did so much reading. I don't even remember all the stats and stuff I read because it goes all over the place.
Yes.
So I did jot a lot of stuff down here. So we'll try to go through some things, as we go. Here's the thing. I think this is the key thing I want to start with though. Like like you hear this all the time, like, oh, manufacturing's gone in the U.S. Like we have none here. And
not true.
They're getting that from because we just, the headcount for laborers for manufacturing.
Yeah.
Yes. That has dramatically dropped, but I did not know this, but that may be the case, but we've been far more productive with the few that we have than what you'd think.
Well, that's true, and a lot of that has to do with the industries that poured into manufacturing are gone too. Like the steel industry is all but gone in the U.S., right? Like there's not a whole lot of U.S. steel left. We're getting a lot of that out of Canada. We're getting a lot of that out of China. So a lot of the basic stuff, when we had – when during World War II, when we had a real rise in manufacturing, we had the capacity, the buildings, all the things that we needed. And we basically got everything we needed from within our borders, right? And once we hit into the 60s, after World War II was over, even during the Vietnam conflict, we began to disperse manufacturing out of the country. But that became, that also came along with a lot of the U.S. restrictions on, you know, tax restrictions and the raising of corporate taxes. And see, here's the thing that I don't think, and this isn't a left or right thing, but I'm going to say this. This is a thing that I don't think the left understands when they say, well, you know, the Chinese people, you know, they need the money, so we want to help. No, we're not helping them. And here's why. When a kid works in a factory for 12 hours a day and he's paid the equivalent of a U.S. dollar for that day, you're not helping him. You're turning him into a as close to slave labor as humanly possible. And my question is always, well, okay, so let's say we just start opening factories here and all I want to pay you is a dollar a day. Are you going to take it? Like, I don't think that they realize that by allowing China, Taiwan, Vietnam to cheapen production, they've also cheapened labor to the point where they're paying almost nothing.
Okay, but I don't totally agree with that, because there are a lot of places where that dollar a day is like triple the amount of anybody else working in that village.
I would say if it's not a communist country, I would agree with that.
Well, I'm just saying, but that is exactly what you're seeing, like, because the same way here, like if I get paid, if I'm sitting in LA and I get paid so much, that's only going to go so far.
Yeah.
If I get paid the same amount and I move to like freaking Iowa, man, that's a whole different ballgame.
It's going to go a lot further.
Right. So it's just, there is a lot of places where, you know, we think, oh my gosh, they're only getting paid $2 an hour, but that's like a way premium wage that they can't get anywhere else in that whole entire region.
Yeah. Fair enough.
There is those cases. Now, I'm not saying everything's like that.
Yeah.
But I know from in the IT world, especially when you talk about some places in India and stuff. I mean, they don't pay these people in India very much, but they're getting paid what we think is like hardly anything. But that's like a wicked, awesome salary. Now, granted, nowadays that's kind of all leveled out a little bit, but you know, that used to be a huge thing. Everybody thought, oh, how can they be doing? They're getting, I mean, it's like slavery, but it turns out, well, really in the region they're in, it was like premium, you know, they're getting paid really well for where they live.
Yeah.
Now, I don't agree with the child labor thing. I mean, I think anybody would be silly if they agreed to have like child labor and stuff. I think a lot of that, or at least some of it, has declined, especially when you're talking about the mining and the stuff like that. I think there's less children involved nowadays because of cultural public pressure on that kind of stuff. But it's less than it was. I don't think it's gone, but it's less. But yeah, anyway, so let's get back to this though. So the video was 4 years. They took this. There was this 4 year journey to do this thing, right? Mm-hmm. And what they found was like there was a real problem with tooling. So in other words, molds had to be made for things.
Yep.
And they were struggling to find who could actually build the molds. You're talking tooling and die people to actually build the molds to make these things. You had plenty of people who could inject the plastics and all that kind of stuff, but you had to provide the molds or something, right?
Yeah.
Vendor availability, like even availability to have like a, you know, to get somebody to do something, because they're just over, it's just mat capacity and stuff. And then you had these like, what did he say? You had to order like 10,000 as minimum quantities for some things in order to make it to where these people would do things or not.
Yeah.
In order to make them worth building it or whatever. And then you'd have like months of lead time for this or that and all this stuff. And it ended up being like, in order to fulfill these needs in the U.S., it was like these niche kind of places. And it was a premium because they're, you know, they're one of the few things that can do it. So like, yeah, we'll do it, but you're going to have to pay for it. And there was also time constraint there. There was also resource problems there. It's a very specialized thing and it's priced like it. So, and then when he finally did get it together and they like, he priced it at a, I don't even remember how much it was, but it was like ridiculous for some grill scrubber.
Yeah.
It was silly. And it sold out.
Yeah.
Because it was USA made. People bought it. And it was, but it was like, it was, man, it was not, I don't know. I got to look at the, how much, I don't remember how much it was now.
I forgot. Fully American made product is inexpensive.
No.
But I will say this because I am a man and I am human, that a lot of American made products, they play that up in order to drive the price up.
Sure.
Well, the label's made in America. Label's important, right? What you've got here, you know, labels versus law, made in the USA without stepping on a landmine. That's kind of dangerous too, right? Because there's made in the USA and there's assembled in the USA. And you have to be careful what you put because, I mean, I've worked for companies that say built in the USA. And they were. They were built. Company I worked for at the time built everything at a plant in Louisiana before the flood happened, before the last hurricane, that the one that destroyed them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but they were buying all their parts out of China, South America, India. All those countries were shipping in parts. So they couldn't say made in America, but they could say assembled in America. I don't know if there's a lot of truly 100% American made companies out there anymore, as far as just,
that's one of, they're very specialized. They're very niche, and they're, it's usually not like, as far as manufacturing go, not large operations. Yeah. So you're talking about little small places that don't, they can't scale to like, if you wanted to do like a full blown, you know, I need a million units kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and even if you could, it would take them a long time to do so, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an example. I was going to start a t-shirt company. My initial order was going to be 1,000 shirts. I couldn't find anyone local that could take that amount on. It wasn't the design or the logo or the screen printing. They were all capable of that. It was the actual production of it. Like, and 1,000 doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a lot of t-shirts. And the answer I got from every one of them was, sorry, we just don't have the ability to manufacture that much. Like, we do 50, 100 at a shot. We're doing 1,000. Just not our thing, you know? So yeah, you're right. Like, there's a lot of manufacturing and quantity issues that come along with that. Somebody orders 1 million units. That's a big job for somebody who's an artisan, so to speak.
Yeah, a small shop, because they're the only ones that have all this specialized tool.
Yeah.
And even then, you're talking about tooling and stuff they need in order to scale up that. And there's another problem.
Yeah.
Here's an example. Like, I know that I was looking for a true U.S.-made hoodie.
Yeah.
I was thinking, you know, and this has been a while, by the way. And there is a place, right? I don't remember the name of it, but they have USA-made clothing that is fully USA made, mm-hmm. but you're going to pay $100 for a hoodie.
Yeah.
It's not printed. It's not, I mean, there's nothing. It's a plain hoodie that's just made in the USA, and it's $100.
Yeah.
Now, it's great quality apparently, and like, it's all this stuff, but
I'm not paying $100 for a hoodie.
But that's the difference between, like, you can go to like Amazon, you buy one for $20 versus $100.
Yeah.
Now, I think there's a, I don't know. I mean, I would say, sure, go buy, you know, you should buy this $100 hoodie because it's USA made. But man, I mean, you're talking to your fan, like, I don't have that kind of disposable income to make a choice of that extreme.
Yeah. You know? You got to buy a hoodie for everybody in your family, and you got five people living in your house. It's $500 for hoodies.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Not that you would do that, but it's still, though, it's like, you know, anyway, so that's where we're at. So, here we talk. Go back to the made in USA thing, right? Mm-hmm. So the marketing claim, made in USAA, but then there's the FTC's bar, is that it's got all or virtually all domestic content plus processing, right? Mm-hmm. So what kills me about stuff like that is like the especially automotive, like we have our plant here in wherever, Texas or whatever, but like
Saskatoon,
but all the parts are coming from Mexico, which all those are coming from China.
Yeah.
So China to Mexico to US, right? So is it really made in the USA? Well, it's put together in the USA, and that's what the I think the made in USA with imported parts, I think that's what they have to actually claim, or assembled in USA.
Well, it's like the Ford thing, built Ford Tough. They don't say made Ford Tough. They say built Ford Tough.
Yeah, they put all the parts together.
And, yeah. So, yeah, you know, that being said.
But Mexico, I guess that brings up that point. Like, Mexico's our top, we buy more stuff from Mexico. They manufacture more stuff than any other country. But that's a little misleading, because while we see this made in China stuff all the time, but China's actually making a lot of the stuff for Mexico that then takes that stuff and makes it for US.
Well, here's the thing I would say, if you were looking for a good way to say it. We are manufacturing partners with Mexico. We are consumer partners for China.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the products that we buy from China, we buy without any manufacture here. This contraption right here is not manufactured here, right? So
– that's why it says designed in California. Apple,
yeah.
But it's designed
by – but that we are consumers for China. We are partners with Mexico in the manufacturing field, I would say. So let me ask you this question. Do you think that there being such tight clamp on borders has hurt that partnership with Mexico as far as manufacturing goes?
I mean, it's got to do something. I mean, but I think more than that, really, it's just hurt the influx of the workers into the U.S. more than anything.
Yeah.
I mean, the people that are punching out and doing these manufacturing gigs, they're not the ones coming over. Well, unless they just leave the factory and go somewhere. But, you know, I think it's mostly that's not really been impacted as far as like the supply. Well, I can't say. The problem there is that you get statistics get a little wonky with how what's affected what. Yeah, and you get two different stories of propaganda when you look at that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, you don't really actually know, you know what is said. And a lot of times that can be telling to a degree. But most of the time, I think the statistics are so skewed, we're never really going to know. But, you know, one thing we were talking about, Reggie, that's very interesting, too, is the tool and die thing.
Mm-hmm.
We lack not only the machinery, but we lack the skilled, trained individuals on how to run and manufacture the dies and tools that are needed for factories to run. Like, I think this is more of the complication than the whole trade or anything like that is we have allowed manufacturing to just float away from us so far that I think there was a point when people began to realize that, well, there is no need for a tool and die maker right now. And they left, and that wasn't passed down. That wasn't given to the next generation. It was just kind of left like roadkill on the side of the road. We can't really do anything with it. But I feel like we would have to fix that problem first, right? We would have to, you can't open a bunch of factories and then go, well, crap. Now we got to figure out how to run them. You got to have some people that understand and have knowing and knowledge. And the problem is that there's less and less places for them to go and get that training.
I think we've talked about before how there's a trade deficit in how, and we absolutely are not across the whole trades, period. Yeah. But the tool and die, I think, is one of the ones that are like the most in demand. Like, we don't have enough. Period. I think that it was like we'd have to double the amount of tool and die people we have right now in order to even come close.
Well, in order to even make a start.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. What was it? 66,000 was the number of tool and die people we had in the country. I have it somewhere in here, but we'll get to that.
It wasn't high.
No. And I mean, it was like the, I even asked AI, I said, is it even possible to like gear up for that? And that's why it created this whole math of doubling the capacity kind of thing. But we'll get to that in a minute. But yeah, I think that there was, apprenticeships throughout is thin relative to retirement. So to point out to what you were saying, yeah, the people who can set these things up. And let's see. And you were talking about, say the thing from your kids' school.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody that was at the school my son's going to attend. He was actually,
which is a trade school,
which they is do a trade school
in high school. Yeah.
Well, and he actually made the statement. He's like, we could run full classes of tool and die people for 20 years. And he says, we wouldn't get enough capacity to get what the state we're in needs, more or less start to make an impact on a national level. And a lot of it is they don't have people to teach. Nobody actually knows. Like, one of the saddest things that I've ever seen is when something that is really powerful and useful dies due to a lack of interest. And I think that's part of where the tool and die industry has gone, is there's a lack of interest. And mainly because, really, honestly, if we've only got 66,000 in the U.S., I would assume that that's because there's not that many jobs in that industry. Therefore, what would be the point of going and learning tool and die if there are no available jobs? Even doubling capacity, I don't even think would begin to scratch the surface.
I don't think so either. But it was just a question of, like, how could we do that? And that was even a big task, right?
Yeah. Like, that's – here's what I think. And I'm normally – dude, I'm all about making it here. But the question therein lies – how do we fix it in the sense of creating a fertile environment for that to grow in, right? Because there has to be a fertile environment for that to grow in.
Well, keep in mind, I think this goes a lot deeper than tariffs and trades all this stuff, right? Because you have your income needed in the U.S. as an average to do something is pretty ridiculously high.
Yeah.
To live in this country is actually really expensive when it comes to finding a place to live, whether that's renting or buying. But I mean, even if we're talking about renting or whatever, the food that we have, it's just the taxes we have. That it is pretty expensive to live here. Okay,
and here's the way to compare that. There are countries out there right now, Italy, Spain, even some of the Nordic countries. They are paying people to move there to drive up their economy and bring value to their working class. Whereas in America, we have so many that the wage has been strapped so low that many of those have trouble making ends meet. We are a very expensive country.
Yeah.
Even on the base level, we're very expensive.
It is. But I mean, that's the thing, like when you talk about manufacturing and everything else, because I mean, it's not just the story of labor being cheaper offshore. That's not actually the whole case. And sometimes it's not. It's just, but when you talk about trying to bring manufacturing back and like actually you're building the facilities, you're doing all this stuff, then you're trying to do all these things. There's a lot of components, including tool and die, including what your labor force is going to look like, all this kind of stuff. And so it becomes like, you know, when I think was it Henry Ford who did the whole thing where I'm going to build this town and then I'm going to make sure there's a school, there's a hospital, there's all this stuff there. And he built it all out and was like, here you go.
Yeah.
And it was like this whole self-sustaining thing so he could have his factory staffed and everything, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like you got to start over in that aspect. But the thing is, okay, so now you're in the U.S. Let's say you're gonna build widgets. So you take the widgets and you're going to like, okay, it's going to cost, you know, we got to hire these people. Well, how much we got to hire that if they're in Saskatchewan? Whatever.
You mean Saskatoon.
Saskatoon. Okay. My bad. Saskatoon.
Saskatchewan's north.
That's right. So Saskatoon, you know, well, in order for people to want to get work there, you got to pay them $20 an hour.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's $20 an hour. Now, how many people we need? Well, we're going to need about 5,000 people in order to make this manufacturing plant go, blah, blah, blah. Well, the population of Saskatoon is only, you know, 30,000. So how are we going to do that? And then it's like, well, we got to encourage this. You know, it's a bigger thing. And then, besides all that, we can't find a tool. a tooling person in order to like make our molds and stuff that we need for this stuff. So what we're going to have to do is we're going to, you know, it's a huge challenge here, yeah. man. I mean,
yeah.
And the thing is like you, and this is why it's like offshore is still thriving and everything because they've been working in these manufacturing stuff so long now, they got all the tooling and all the stuff in order to do this crap.
Well, and I'm going to say this too. A lot of people might think that we're picking on buying from other countries. That's actually not at all what I'm saying. I appreciate artisanship from anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, doesn't matter.
I mean, if you're a master at your craft, you could live with Santa Claus. I'd be fine with that, right? Like I'll order it from you if I think it's worth it, right? What I'm saying is we as a country, we don't seem to have that pride anymore, right? That we want to be self-sustaining.
I mean, you do though.
Yeah, but
it was smaller.
Yeah, but it's also okay, so you make an American-made product. Well, dude, it's hard to convince someone to buy your product when your product is 500% more expensive than this product I can buy at Walmart. And on top of that, we're in the middle of an economic crunch. It's obvious what's happening right now. The middle class is getting reamed right now. Like reamed, and I am middle class, and I go to bed at night sore and achy from getting reamed.
It's tough, dude.
And I feel like we've created this just vortex of just poison that's going on right now, because even if you are an American-made company, God bless you if you are, your prices are so high, it's going to be really difficult for you to survive amongst a group of people that oddly enough are about as consumer driven as anybody out there. Right. Like it's so odd to me. It's so odd to me. And you'll never make it make sense that we as a country, 462 million people, we have gotten so bad with money and so far in the hole that the more we try to climb out, the more strapped we become and the harder it becomes.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, here's the thing. If you go down to like, I'm trying to think of an example here. Okay. Up in Nashville, Indiana. Okay. Little crafty town, you know, they got all these artisans and stuff. That's what it is. It's like pretty much like this little, that's still there.
It's like a little Gatlinburg.
It is a little Gatlinburg. And Gatlinburg, same way. Gatlinburg is a little more touristy, but like Nashville has like, you know, furniture that is, they make hardwood stuff, they hand make Amish, it and all this stuff. Yeah. They got all kinds of things there, right?
Yeah.
Art, whatever. It's actually a really neat little town to kind of go visit and stuff. It's really kind of cool. Matter of fact, we actually bought a couple recliners from there because it was like, they had these like oak handmade recliners. I just couldn't pass up. They were freaking amazing, but very expensive. But like, it's like that will last longer than my grandkids. Yeah. Yeah, so we bought anyway, beside the point, but you know, those are really those niche places where you find the artisans and they're actually making stuff by hand and they're taking special orders and it, you know, that kind of thing. So if you think about those type of places, but then now you want those to be, you know, let's supply furniture to Bob's furniture store and they have 700 places throughout the country. And that's where you're going to go buy your furniture from Bob's furniture store. And it's made by these manufacturers who are all in the US.
Yeah.
So can you do that? No, because those specialized handmade furniture places can't scale to that level.
Yeah.
And even if they can, it's not going to be the same price point as like Value City Furniture.
It's invariably, in order to create a process that large, it's going to take something out of the product.
Well, and I mean, Yes, but you could. I mean, you could. You could like talking tooling and die here. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it's about. It's like if you have the right tooling and die and you know the right stuff, you can scale up that way. But then again, there you're back to that problem again.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought of it. That's another reason I was bringing this up too, is because like you know if you go up to places like that, I mean, like there was a what was it? It's like an end table, right? And now it's all wood and everything else, but you know, $500.
Yeah.
For just an end table.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a lot of money for an end table.
No.
You know, a chair, like a sofa that was like, you know, $4,000, but it wasn't anything special about it. It was just made all wood. You know, this they made their own, the cushions and everything else and all this kind of stuff. That's a lot. Dude, very, very expensive for that kind of thing. Versus you go to like a Value City Furniture, $500, you get the sofa that's pretty actually really comfortable.
Yeah.
You know,
not
but
bad.
Yeah. But anyway, I think we're back to this like one guy who knows tool and die and he's trying to train 30 people.
Yeah.
And if he can even do that. And that's a big problem. And like I said, so I asked AI how you could probably, and it came up with this like math of doubling capacity. And basically what it was talking about was like, say your tool and die capacity right now is 100. You're trying to get to 200. And it's just a numbering system for knowing what that level is. So you could do it a couple different ways with people heavy being like you plus 60% headcount of what you already have over 7 years. And that's quadrupling apprenticeships and upscaling the CNC machinists, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you're trying to scale that productivity up another 25% and get some other HSM, EDM cells and better cams and simulations and stuff like that. I won't go into all that. But anyway, but you're talking like that 1.6 times a 1.25 equals a two times. But you're talking over 7 years of 60% more headcount plus 25% more productivity using some other things, right? The second option it came up with was you increase your headcount by 30%, then you increase your productivity by 55% using some milling and robotic stuff and things like that, and you get to the same point. Now, what we've done in this country is, and like we talked about before, like we actually have less headcount for manufacturing, but our productivity is higher than it was.
Yes.
Because we've heavily engaged into automation and stuff like that to make everybody be able to do more, right?
Yes.
And I think that's – you're not going to get rid of that, by the way, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that necessarily. But trying to get to the place where you're taking that and then saying, well, now I need to like double my capacity. That's a big ask, right?
It is a big ask. So, all right, what would move the needle, Reggie? Tell me about, would it have to start with government regulation? Would it have to start with would it be consumer reactivity? What would cause a change?
Okay, I think there's a couple things here. TCO over piece price. So what they're talking about is like the total cost of ownership over just these per little pieces of things. That could pull some things in if we lean into that. But that's talking about total cost too, which does include tariffs, freight, over the ocean kind of lead times, all that kind of stuff or whatever. So you're trying to entice that TCO being inshore rather than offshore. One suggestion was like, well, we need to reuse and standardize more on some tooling and everything else, but that doesn't work for everything. I mean, you can only go so far with that.
Here's the thing about that. The only way that would work if there was low diversity in product.
Yeah.
If it was low diversity in product and we were only making two kinds of widgets. Okay. But if you're making 100 different kinds of widgets, that's not going to work.
I think also the biggest thing here is just we should be keep doing more things to encourage, I think, inshore manufacturing. But I think we really got to be careful about that because of the predicament that we're in with the trades and certain things too. I think we have to, I think there's a, it's not in the outline, but one of the things I thought about was there's gotta be a cultural shift in some way to make this happen more realistically. And what I mean by that is I think you can't have this conversation without talking about the disparaging of income between like the C-suite versus the low person on the totem pole.
I would agree with that. Now, to preface what I'm about to say, this has nothing to do with tax rates. This has to do with appreciation of and value of skill and remittance for that skill that's equal to the level of what that skill is, right? There's a reason why plumbers and electricians get paid quite a bit, because that skill deserves that pay.
Yes.
HVAC guys, all those guys, they have a very, very powerful skill. Tool and die makers are extraordinarily gifted and creative individuals who have a strong skill set. You have to meet that strong skill set with the with an equivalent pay, right? I think that, but I think that's a disparity that runs across the board in almost every sure. industry, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't think, like, look, and look, I'm not anti-rich, right? Like, I mean, dude, if you invented the world's greatest Habmaja, what's it, and you made $1 billion, I don't hold anything against Elon Musk, dude. You created Tesla, you created SpaceX, you did all these things. They're incredibly difficult and hard things that have been beneficial. I don't care how much money you make. Make all the money you want to make if you're capable. But what I am saying is it's very, very difficult to encourage people to get into a system to learn a very powerful skill when there's no opportunity for powerful money. Money that can change, and I say change your life, just give you opportunity to own a home, opportunity to do all the things that want to be done. That's where you run into the problem, right? Like, there's, you know, we've become a society where we see the C-suite as the pinnacle, which really that's the 1%.
Not even right? that.
Not even that. So, yeah. You know, I mean, and people all the time, when I say this, you know, if you make $30,000 in the United States, you're one of the 1% in the world. Right. Like, it's like, so I think that, but to me, that says something about, that doesn't say much for the guy making 30 grand, right? Like, you, that guy, you know, one of the lowest paid skills out there is management, being able to actually properly and skillfully manage groups of people. As a manager, I've seen that they're probably one of the most underpaid, but there's caveats that come along with that, right? If you're going to make a higher pay, you have to provide a higher skill level, provide a higher product.
Well, yeah. Okay.
Just, I don't know.
Yes. Kind of weird, and you're, yeah. You're right. But what I'm getting at though, is like, we have this corporate culture, where the board, like the larger companies have this board, the board controls everything, yeah. By the way. And what the board does is, I mean, they're like looking at stock prices and investments and stuff like that. So even in a company like whoever, Acme, whatever, and let's say they bring in, you know, $2 billion in annual revenue, they had, you know, a average, they grossed 32% profit or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. They still had, you know, so they made money.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a 32% out of the 2 billion, but their stock price remained stagnant. That to the board is not a winning annual financial year.
I don't mind saying, to me, that's just greed.
Exactly. This is where I'm going.
Yeah.
We've got to this point where it's like, they're like, oh, we got to have, you know, there is a point to being conservative. I'm not saying that with the fiscal or economics of your corporate stuff. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that and make sure that you take care of the business, because if you don't take care of the business, you can't have people to work the business, period. Yeah. But it's got to the point where, like, you have this culture where you know, you have these, you're still getting like these C-level people who are getting $30 million a year bonuses. Then you lay off 1,000 people from the company.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that doesn't.
And then wonder why you're, then wonder why your staff is, the morale's in the dirt. And
you don't give people raises. Like it comes around to your annual merit reviews and stuff. And like, well, y'all did great, but we don't have anything to give you. Yet your company just reported, you know,
$100 million in revenue and in profit,
in 33% profit, and all this other kind of stuff. You know, that's that. How are you gonna you got to shrink that? Well, and I think the culture needs to push that way a little bit. I'm not saying that. I'm definitely not saying because I've seen. Look, I don't want to be a C-level person. I mean, because that's like the decisions they make or whatever. I mean. They go in and out the door a lot because they can't do what the board wants them to do and all this kind of stuff. It's a very volatile position. Mm-hmm. I get it now, but and I don't think they should get paid nothing or, you know, all that kind of stuff. But at the same token, we and they're not all companies are like this, by the way. But I'm just saying, there's a lot of corporate America that has gotten so bad at this. It's really ridiculous.
Well, I was in management for years, and I'll tell you what I learned in management. If you're managing something, it's already out of control. If you ask me to manage a situation, that usually means the situation's out of hand.
Yeah, you're trying to now corral it.
Yeah. I always talk to people about leadership, right? And I think one of the things that we forget about is, you know, and I see this happen all the time. A company will have a terrible year. And instead of stepping back away from the terrible year and going, we need to look internally first and figure out what's going on within our company, they look externally and then wound up destroying their morale and their structure even more because they start carving one of the greatest. And I said this one time, and I'm sure if the guy's watching this, he's probably at home right now wanting to put his hands around my neck. Cause I was right. I had an owner come to me once and say, well, we didn't do well this year, so we're going to cut all the commissions. And I didn't say anything. And he goes, well, you're awful quiet. And I said, well, you're going to kill your company.
Going to go down.
If they don't have a reason to sell, they're not going to sell. If you're going to pay them $15 an hour, they're going to act like $15 an hour employees. He told me I was insane. And then he did it. And exactly what I told him would happen. Every good sales employee left the company.
Yeah.
We began to hire people that were literally, they just wanted to get their $15 an hour and go home.
Yep.
Right. And then a year later comes to me and says, well, why didn't you tell me? Well, I did tell you. I told you before you did it. I was like, you will kill us if you do this. Because if I was a commissioned salesperson, and by God, I was a good commissioned salesperson, and I knew how to do the hustle and the dance and make money. And I told him, I said, if you take their commissions, if you take that ability they have to make that extra money so that they can, you know, buy Bobby the bike for Christmas and do the things that they want to do, you're going to kill your morale and eventually kill your team. And that's exactly what happened. But I say that to say this. C-suite oftentimes puts the blame in the wrong place. I know you're in the board meeting and you got the ticker going across the television and all things happening, but that doesn't give you any insight into the morale of your company and to the health of the people that work for you in that general sense. And I think that's part of what's happened to manufacturing is the bottom line in the C-suite became so important. We were like, well, we can make this widget for 2 cents less a unit in Bangladesh and pay the Bangladesh employee 1/3 of what we're paying our employees. And then that'll cover our import costs and we'll save $1 a widget and our bottom line will go up. Forget what's going on with the employees and the people that we're stepping on to do this. But we're C-suite employees, and that's all we look at.
Right. But again, this goes into more of like, then we're into like, what wage can we do, the cost of living and stuff that we have in the country. And I think that it becomes such a it's closely tied into everything because of the way all this works.
Well, we're the only country in the world that plays the bolo game, which here's the bolo game. Okay, everybody's broke. Let's raise the price.
I know.
Oh, well, now they're buying it and they're going into debt and they got credit card debt and they don't have any really liquid money. Let's raise the price.
So I want to get back to this though, but yeah. Like you're right. But like we have to make a choice in this country. And I'm talking about the people do, like mm-hmm. what we're going to support, what we're not going to support. If we really want to bring more manufacturing back into the States, more opportunity there in the States, then we have to start doing some things. And so not just the stuff we were already talking about, but you know, money from the government should, like, we have to start saying, okay, we need to actually, there has to be more from, and I hate to say it, but like more from the traditional university uh-huh. funds and everything else. It needs to go more, not to just there, but we're going to funnel some back into some tech
yeah.
things in order to make those things happen.
Yeah.
Because until you actually pull that through like that, you won't get that many more.
No, you won't.
It won't matter, you know? And as soon as we, as Americans actually value that stuff better, which in our part of the country, we're not too bad with that. I think we generally tend to, we have a lot of electricians and stuff like that. Yeah. Well, we're still deficit there as far as what we got, but we don't have a negative opinion about these.
It's yeah, not, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's what I mean. Like, the other thing too is like, I honestly think this is a really great opportunity to say like, hey, look, here's some targeted visas type of things for experienced tool and die people. Let's pull them in from other places. Let's get them in here.
Let's get them to come and do some work for us.
I mean, you know, I mean, we don't need any more IT people. We don't. They're not flooding in here anyway. They're actually, I mean, they're trying to. Don't get me wrong. We're still the hotbed of everything, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, that stuff. We still need to do that, right? And spend more on grants and more on some low interest student loan stuff for trade school people. Or even have these. You know, they have these. I think the one that's close-ish is called Maker 13, and it's like this huge, like pretty much shop that's full of every daggone tool or machine or whatever you could possibly imagine. You can pay a monthly fee in order to like use it and get trained on it and all that stuff. So you can go in there and you can make your own stuff, right? It's really cool. Well, you'd have to get into like, can we make these things like in a regional initiative where you have like, here's a government backed program to get so many more people in for particular programs and stuff.
You know? I struggle with that. And here's why.
Well, I don't like the government touching.
Government touching anything.
I don't either, but I'm just saying it's an option.
What I would suggest would be companies like, you know, the big companies like the Fords and those guys and the Chevys and the Apples. If you truly want to do more business here in America and you want to do a better product, put together some programs to encourage it. Instead of, you know, we're going to give you a blah, 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 blah. Hey, you know what? We're going to start a program. And in that program, we're going to start tooling and dying some of our own parts in the U.S. We're going to train you to be a tool and die maker. And if you go all the way through this training, we're going to reward you with this bonus and this pay. But you got to get to the end of the training, and then maybe you have to commit to a year.
Whatever it is.
You know what I'm saying? What I really think we broke it was I love Nick Freitas. I have never seen a problem solved by giving the government more money and more power. Never once. So, and I feel like what's happened is our captains of industry, our biggest countries in the U.S. have went, well, the government will handle it. No, they won't. Are you stupid?
Yeah.
You can't be that blind as to think that our government is hyped up to help you in any way, shape, or form. Like, the last thing we need is another government program. What we need is for American companies to take control of their destinies, right? we're not going to have the government do this. We're going to do this. Instead of giving Franco over there a $30 million bonus, we're going to give him a $15 million bonus, and we're going to take $15 million and pour it into this bonus, in this program that's going to not only make our company more solvent and give our employees more opportunities and raise our morale and make more people attracted to come and work for us, but we're going to give people that challenge and that direction and that motivation to become better, right? Like right now, a lot of companies, there's no motivation to get better, right? Like, you know, one of the things that I've always been a big fan of is talk to your people. You know, get out of your office, go to your people, sit them down in a room and say, hey, I'm not here to crucify you or I just need some honest feedback, right? And tell me what's going on and how you see things is going. We as companies think that if we give somebody some money and then we give them a little extra money from time to time and call it a bonus, that's somehow going to satiate an individual's need to become better, faster, stronger, right? And that's part of what's happened to our industry is the corporations have just taken their hands off the wheel and be like, let the government handle all the regulation, the training, the corporate this.
Well, I mean, speaking of like regulation and all this, I mean, I think the labeling and everything for this stuff we weren't clear about that. We were talking to it earlier, but you know, there's really not a lot of clear labeling around made in USA type of thing. Cause that'll help people too. Like I look at that everything I buy, generally I say, hey, where's this made? Almost everything I buy, I look at that. Right. And, you know, having some real consensus on like, if you knew like this was assembled in the US with parts from here,
parts from Ireland,
you know?
Okay.
Okay. If it was like, I don't know if it was made in, you know, I don't know. I can't even think of like what a good, how would you say it? Made with imported, parts, but made domestically put together, you know, something clearer than what we have now would help a lot. Where's my dogs? But I think just to recap a little bit, I mean, manufacturing isn't gone. We're actually still producing a lot.
We are, yes.
The headcount has changed dramatically.
And automation has changed it dramatically.
Automation has changed dramatically. But again, it's like these things that are funneling through in nearshore are coming from Asia. And then you still have the tool and die as a big choke point here to even start making any kind of progress with all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
So, yeah, I guess here's the thing. I think we need to be smarter consumers, right? if you're an American product and you're trying to do this, I think that there's going to be a real art form to like how you could make a lot of your stuff in the US. If you can do it, you can charge a premium. Look, all this data points this out. If you can do it and you charge a premium and it's got this stuff, people buy it.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, there's a reason to do that. Now it's about scaling and everything else. So, but yeah, I guess that's kind of in short. I know we kind of there's so much here. This is what there's so much here with this picture, though. It's really hard to put this in like an hour and 15
minutes.
I
read so many reports, agriculture reports.
Yeah,
I mean, people don't realize how many prongs are in this and how many metrics would have to change in order for us to go have what I would call a manufacturing renaissance. Right, like it would be the epic amount of just baseline changes that would have to make before we ever talked about policy and before we ever talked about private ownership and all the things that would be involved in it is so big. Like I literally one night I read and read and read. And then I was like, I can't read anymore because I'm starting to lose what I'm reading. Right. Like there's so much information out there. I would like to recognize something before we go. There are several, we're in a government shutdown right now, blah, blah, blah. We're not going to get into all that. But I would like to give kudos to some people in our government. There are several representatives, coincidentally none of them being on the left, who have foregone their salaries until further notice to make sure that the military gets paid. they have taken their salaries and diverted them to the military and to first responders so that they do not go unpaid. That may not seem like a lot to a lot of people, but to me, that shows that there is still some merit to being a U.S. senator or congressperson. There are still good people out there that don't want to see good people suffer. And I want to just give a shout out to those people, you know, one of them being Nancy Mace. A couple of them just said, don't pay me. As long as there's a shutdown and the our military is not getting paid, don't pay me. Pay them. And to me, that's a step in the right direction. Is it a cure? No. But it's a step in the right direction. And I think that needs to be recognized. And what I would say to the people who are about to feel the sting of this, because there's a whole lot of people starting Monday that are going to really start to feel the heaviest weight of this shutdown. The truth is out there. Read it and react accordingly.
Okay, let's be real.
The Dems
let me be real.
The Dems have voted 13 times to keep the government shut down.
Let's
Biden level spending. Biden level spending, by the way. They've voted 13 times to shut our government.
But brother, look, man. Here's the thing. Yes, 13 times. But wanting to fund, like, you know, some gay pride thing.
Oh, I know. They're basically holding the government hostage for $1.4 trillion is what they're doing.
But that $1.4 trillion has no business being spent by the American people, period.
No, it has. It's not. It does not. If it was $1.4 trillion for, you know, curing the homeless problem in the United States, I'd probably be okay with it. But I don't want to fund transgender operas
No, we have no business.
Indonesia. It's not that I care whether there are transgender people in Indonesia. I'm sure there's transgender people everywhere.
And okay,
I personally don't think that we should be responsible for their opera.
I don't hear about your theater production around this whatever thing. I don't really care. It could be. I don't care what it is. I don't want to fund that with tax dollars.
Yeah.
Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
The second thing here, I just want to wrap real quick and say, I don't want to hear another person give me some sob story about some Lucy Liu who had, like, she has six kids and the SNAP stuff is all she has in order to do this and blah, 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 or whatever. Look, every sob story you have, there's 13 other stories about some chick who gets $2,500 a month to go get, and she sells $1,000 of it online The system is broken, people. If you can't figure that out, you are an idiot. But I don't want kids to go without food and everything else. Where's your families? Like, what is going on with these freaking people?
Okay, here's where we are.
There's a lot of broken things. Don't get me wrong.
Reggie, here's what it boils down to. Reggie. And here's where I get in a lot of arguments because I'm very clear about this. I should not be fiscally responsible for your poor decision making. If you, and I'm going to say something, it's going to get me some hate. If you weren't smart enough after you had the first two not to have four more and realize that you probably weren't going to be able to afford it, you probably should have stopped doing what you were doing. And if you expect me to feel sorry for you because you had six kids by five different men, and none of those men cared. After man number two, you were well aware of what was causing the problem. You should have stopped, hit the brakes. And we can sit here all day long and talk about, oh, the trauma and the it's all personal decisions. It's personal responsibility. And just because you chose not to take any, I don't hate you. I had children and got married and did things the right way and take care of my kids, and I work hard. I work three jobs. You know, I'm a lunatic. I'm out here doing everything I can to keep my family above water. You want me to feel sorry for you? No.
Hey, take that $1.4 trillion
and
develop a tool and die thing
and give
the Karens
jobs
that have six kids
able
to, you know.
Yeah, turn them into tool and die makers. I like it. Look, I told Reggie the other day, he has the tools to solve all the world's problems.
I'm just saying, look, nobody is going to say, oh, we want all the kids to go and get and blah, blah, blah. No,
and nobody's saying we want the kids to starve.
That is not
that's
all.
That's not it.
It's just the fact that we, there, you, oh.
All right, so I'm going to say something even more unpopular.
Mm.
And here, I was about to. Here's another problem, and this is going to get me some heat too. If the churches were doing what they were supposed to be doing, we wouldn't need a welfare system.
Well, I'll just point out this. Here's the thing. Where my church is, there's not, you don't see a lot of homeless people around. Yeah. There's a lot of families in need.
Yeah.
And we do what we're supposed to do.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Here's the thing, Reggie. Here's the thing. I'm so tired of sitting around and listening to churches talk about, whoa, well, we're our fiscal year, you know, we brought in $3 million. Now we're keeping $2.5 million in the discretionary fund, and we're going to spend $500,000 on discretionary fund.
But a lot of churches are doing more than you think. I just want to point this out.
I'm not taking away from any church, dude. Like, there are a lot of churches out there that are doing it.
They do a lot. But if
every church was doing it, we wouldn't have this. We wouldn't need a welfare system.
Well, where's the Catholic Church?
Yeah.
I mean,
now I got to say
they do parishes, or whatever you want to call it.
Catholics got the service thing down.
They do. All I'm saying is, like, you know, Southeast, for instance, you would never know, because you think, oh, they got this big building and they do all this and oh my gosh. But it was $225 million they had given away to all kinds of stuff.
And I'm not saying that there's not churches that do it.
But
there's a lot of churches out there that have a nice big box of coffer money.
I do just want to say it's more complicated than that, though. It's like the homeless thing, right? Where there's really these people.
Well, homeless is the wrong phrase, first of all. Homeless is a phrase
unhomed,
that was,
you know,
not even unhomed.
What do you want to call
homeless,
it?
Homeless.
The choice of being not
most homeless to me Street says living. Homeless to me says, hey, I lost a job, I got kicked out of my house, but if I can get a job offer, I can bounce back and be good.
Yeah, there's not
when
there's
you
not,
choose yeah. to be on the street, I no longer consider you homeless. I consider you a vagrant, because if somebody comes up to you and says, hey, here's how you get out of this, and you're going to go. And I know there's all kinds of things to consider, mental health and blah, 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 and trauma. I'm really getting worn out with that word. But when someone makes the choice, I can get help, but I would rather live on the streets, then you no longer get to be labeled homeless.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I've volunteered a lot for lots of homeless organizations around here. Lots. I've done it many, many times. But for one, because I'm a little bigger guy, I'm usually watching out for, they want me there to help watch out for the other people, because not all the homeless people are, they got their head on straight. And I mean, I've had to step between things. It's really not, it's different than what you all may think it is.
Some people have severe mental illness.
Well, they're cracked out on something. They're an addict, and it's all kinds of things. But okay. But what I'm saying is, like, it's so much more complicated, but at the same token, I've seen some recent, like, things from, like, Portland and San Francisco and stuff, where they're just like zombies out on the street because of the addiction is so out of control. Like that's
what happens
problem.
When you make everything legal.
Well, but anyway, I guess the point here, man, is that, you know, yes, it's a big deal, but I want to get back to the SNAP thing. My mother used benefits when we were kids. She went back to school because she knew that she needed to take care of the family.
Yeah.
So but it wasn't like today. We didn't have a debit card or anything. We went to the community club every week for our bag of government cheese and peanut butter and bread, whatever.
When I was a kid, was back when they had actual little stores.
Well,
that all they sold was government cheese, government bread, government milk.
I mean,
I remember powdered eggs and powdered milk, right? Like all that stuff.
So, I mean, and I'm fully aware.
There is a necessity for it.
But we can do so much more if we were to have our own money, not the government's doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. I am so squeezed right now by taxes and regulations and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
There's a, it's enormous amount, and I won't get into, I'll just say it's well over 40% of how much of my income is gone to taxes and regulations and all that kind of stuff. I'm not even talking about sales tax. I'm not even talking about property tax in there either. So look, I'm a generous person. Yeah. All you're doing with these government programs is misuse and
taking away my ability to be generous.
And taking them away some of my ability to be generous.
Let's be clear. People go, well, Brian, you've never known. Actually, that's not true.
That's not true.
When I grew up, my mom suffered from mental illness. We were homeless at times.
I lived in my truck for a while.
Yeah. Like but my mom would have real years of clarity where she would do really well. And then she would have years where her mental illness would take control and she would spiral. And we lived off of food stamps.
Yeah.
You know, we had to get food stamps. Okay. But here's the thing. Just because you have that life now doesn't mean that you have to have that life forever.
No.
There's so many people out there right now screaming into their phones, the government is taking my benefits. I've been on SNAP and EBT for 13 years, and I think I'm going to be on it for the rest of my life. What does that say about what you think about yourself? That you think that that's the best you'll ever be?
This is the same attitude where like, here's the thing. I went to the store the other day, right? And I was at the customer service thing. I was returning some clothes because it's hard for me to find clothes now because everything's fallen off of me.
Yeah. I got the same problem, man. I'm just too cheap to buy new ones.
I know. But anyway, so I'm at the return because I got too big a size. I had to go get a smaller size or whatever. And this one of the ladies, I guess one of the people came in and she had this big old thing of cupcakes. And they said, look who brought snacks or whatever. And I said, well, if I would have had snacks, I would give it to you or whatever. I just don't have any snacks. And they offered me a cupcake. And I'm like, I said, no, I can't do that. That's like that new, I'm diabetic. I'm staying off all that new way. You're right.
Yeah.
And the attitude was, well, that's good for you. You know, they were like, yeah, that's cool. I'm going to eat it though. And I'm just going to take my pill later. Right.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us are using the government as the pill, man. I mean, it's like, instead of taking care of your own problems and stuff, you're relying on all this other kind of stuff. And that's not good for you either. Like freedom costs something, but you get more out of it.
But here's the thing. Every free ride eventually ends.
It does.
So what do you have planned for when the free ride ends?
But the free ride is on someone else's back too.
I understand that. But what I'm saying is eventually you're going to get a governor, a mayor, a senate, a congressman,
yes,
a president.
It'll be over.
That's going to end your free ride.
Yeah.
But instead of educating, I mean, right now it's cheaper to go to get an extended education than it's ever been. They've got so many programs out there for free education. You could get a great job. I mean, there's so many fields out there that are paying 25, 26, 27 bucks an hour for, you know, medical data entry, stuff like that. And you're telling me that you want to be a slave to the system for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, it goes like this, man. You know, I'm not saying everyone can do like take the opportunity and do. I mean, there are all kinds of situations and stuff that, you know, you're not you're disabled or literally or whatever. My wife is a great example of this. Like when I met her, completely disabled, right, from this whole injury. It's not her fault. She was attacked by an Alzheimer's patient. She was just trying to do her job.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, come on. I mean, you can't, that's not her fault. And it's not like it was unoperable for a long time. And, you know, she's finally got some kind of relief and everything else. Anyway, but the point being is like, you know, yes, that she's not able to work. Right.
Yeah.
Now, thankfully, I do really well because you couldn't live on what they give her. I'm telling you right now, sure. She does not get those EBT $2,500 texts.
No,
she does not. We don't do that. She gets very, very little because I make okay. And so we end up doing well. So she doesn't. But the point is that we don't bank on that either. Like if somebody rips that away, that's really just to help my wife feel like she contributes.
Yeah.
That's all that does, you know? And we're family oriented and we've raised our kids. We're raising our kids that way. And we take care of other families and we do this thing. We look out for our community. That's where we need to be going with this. Yeah. It's the forget about the government supplying all these things. We need to be more community oriented, more helping each other out and have not everything being taken away to some stupid global
government. But on the other side, if the government doesn't get out of our pockets and they keep regulating and taxing us, you're not going to be able to afford to be generous.
No. So, okay, long story long, take the 1.4, dump it into tool and die. There's the end of that. And
problem solved.
Problem solved. You're good. And I don't care about your whiny, you know, cousin Sue who, whatever. I don't care. I mean, I don't want her kids to suffer, but at the same token, I've heard all that enough.
But at the same token, the reason her kids are suffering is because of her decisions.
Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I don't know her. So anyway, thanks y'all for listening. We're going to be back next week with a different kind of thing. Okay. Me and Brian are attending a conference.
Men's conference. We are.
We'll probably just talk about that and a little bit about men's conferences in general because we've been to our fair share. And I think it's kind of an interesting topic to just talk about how some men conferences go. So we'll
this
see.
Is not a men's abortion rally.
We don't know that yet.
I read the outline.
Okay.
This is – or men's anti-abortion rally. This is a men's conference at a – hopefully it's somewhat normal. We hope. But anyway, we'll be back to talk about that next week and tell everybody how that went.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we'll talk about conferences in general, but. So anyway, look, we're R&B Talks. I'm Reggie.
I'm Brian.
We'll see you later.
See you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.